back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you have ever been to Delafield, you know the downtown area has a quintessential, cute, small-town feel to it. There are coffee shops, restaurants, craft shops, and all of them not far from a picturesque lake. But if you were to walk down the sidewalk, you'd have no idea that inside an unassuming office building is a sprawling warren of offices and conference rooms in which some cutting-edge work is being done.
They are the offices of Virtual Wonders, a company that is using augmented and virtual reality to transform the way we can experience historic and natural wonders around the world. At the heart of it is Wisconsin native Corey Jaskolski, the chief technology officer at Virtual Wonders. He was freshly back from an imaging trip to South Africa when we caught up with him at the company's headquarters. Thank you for having us here.
You bet. Glad to have you here.
So you have, and let me see if I have this right, degrees in physics, math, electrical engineering, and computer science. All of them from MIT or just...
No, the math and physics degrees were actually from University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and the computer science, electrical engineering graduate degrees are from MIT.
All right. Well, so what were you thinking you were going to do when you started collecting these degrees?
Well, I really thought I was going to end up with a traditional engineering job. I really loved photography and videography, but I thought those would always be hobbies. And I would end up working at a Lockheed or Boeing or something doing regular engineering work. So I was really happy when I found a way to merge these two, engineering and photography, into a technology for exploration career.
Well, and so talk about how that happened. You know, this work you're doing now has not really existed for all that long. How did things develop in your favor?
One of the first big projects I worked at on an engineering front was a subsea battery pack that could go to the bottoms of the ocean and handle that pressure without being damaged. And while we were working on that, James Cameron, the guy that made the movie Titanic, and maybe now more famously Avatar or Battle Angel, he asked if we could use these batteries in robots to explore and image the inside of Titanic.
How did he even know you were working on them?
Apparently, he heard from a Navy contact that was the main project lead on this, that we were working on these, and he really needed them for these underwater robots. So, you know, fast forward a couple of weeks later, and I'm in a three-man Russian sub, 12,500 feet deep, on the deck of Titanic, running these robots around inside to image the inside of Titanic in a way that hasn't been seen since it's been built. And that's when it really clicked for me. Like, I can use this imaging passion and the engineering that I'm really good at and merge these two together into a brand new career.
Can I ask, how old were you when that was going on?
I think I was 25 when that happened.
That's got to be kind of heady stuff for someone who was in a pretty early stage of his career.
It is, yeah. The trouble with it is when you go down on Titanic when you're 25 or 26, then what do you do next, right? So I've been sort of running my life trying to figure that out.
Well, so from that grew Hydro Technologies, is that right?
Yes. So after graduating from MIT, I started a company building technologies and sensors. A lot of it was for the U.S. military, for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, to test out some new technologies and new ideas. But a lot of that still was in sort of the more sensing area than imaging. So it wasn't really until my involvement with National Geographic that I became really heavy into this main career of technology for exploration.
Well, right. So when did the National Geographic work start?
I started with National Geographic, I think, in 2008. And I started on board at National Geographic headquarters in DC as the director of technology, and developed a lot of cool technologies there. One of them was the next generation Critter Cam, which is a camera system that we could actually suction cup on the back of humpback whales or great white sharks, and, you know, get some really amazing footage, both to help the science to understand what these animals are doing when you can't see them, but also obviously for the National Geographic TV shows and the like.
Were you inventing that stuff or taking advantage of existing technologies and adapting it, or some of both?
A little bit of both. I mean, most of this field and most of engineering in general, I would say, is, you know, use what you can off the shelf, but there's never a perfect solution. I mean, unfortunately, Sony and Panasonic and Canon don't make, you know, whale cameras. So you got to do a bit of inventing in order to make that all work out.
But to some degree, you've created kind of the, you know, the, for lack of a better term, the GoPro of animal cameras.
That's right. That's actually exactly what it is. Something that's small and easy to use and researchers can use instead of just experts. And that's exactly what the CritterCam was.
Well, and so talk about how that work with National Geographic, the sensing work that you were doing as Hydro Technologies, how did it evolve to what you're doing now with Virtual Wonders?
Yeah, as we did more and more of the sensing work and it started to evolve into imaging work. So even a lot of the military stuff we were doing started to move from sensing of, say, sound and pressure and light and stuff like that more into image-based sensing. And at the same time, you know, I became involved with National Geographic and started doing more strict imaging work on the photography and videography side. So over time, that sort of morphed into taking a look at where there's a need in the science and imaging community and where we can develop new technologies to sort of show the world in a different light. And it's evolved into, that's 100% of what I do these days.
Well, it's 100% of what you do these days, but the purpose for it, you're not doing it on behalf of the Navy, you're not doing it on behalf of DARPA, you're kind of doing it on behalf of all of us.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly the cool part of what we do now is that our mission at Virtual Wonders, the company that I co-founded, is to share and protect the world's special places. So we're out there working with the scientists to help image and understand these places in a way that has been hitherto impossible, but also to share that with everyone in the world, to make it as museum exhibits, make it as 360 videos on Facebook, make it as VR headset experiences that everyone in the world can experience. Because these places, in some cases, are really hard to get to, like Church of the Nativity in the West Bank is not necessarily a safe place to go, or the Congo is not necessarily a safe place to go. And being able to share this with everyone so we can all appreciate them while they still exist are, I think, pretty awesome goal.
It is not always a safe place to go. How did you get used to going to these kinds of places?
Yeah, I'm not sure I ever did. I mean, still, going to the Congo and working in places where you're one of the few people without a AK-47 slung over their shoulder is still a little intimidating. Working underwater with sharks without cages is still a little intimidating. I think the answer for me is that the work is important enough that it justifies the risk. Not being afraid at all isn't bravery. It's stupidity, right? So I think it's just gauge the risk and decide if the science and the sharing of this with people is worth it.
Do you have scrapes, narrow escapes, and that kind of thing?
Always, yeah. A lot of the scrapes and narrow escapes. One story that I like to tell, which is probably not actually one of the more crazy dangerous ones, but I was diving, doing 360-degree video when that was a new thing with sharks, particularly with bull sharks. And bull sharks are pretty scary animals. They're, I think, second in the list of fatal shark attacks right after great whites. And so I was laying on the bottom of the ocean floor, maybe 50 or 60 feet deep on scuba with a camera that I built hanging off my back. And the people on the top of the ship were trying to attract the sharks in. So they were throwing fish guts and blood over the side of the boat. And it's raining down fish guts on me 60 feet below. And so the bull sharks are getting really agitated, as you might imagine. But one did something that I had no idea a shark could even do. It swam up right in front of my face. And it just stopped and hovered. And it's so close to me that I can't even see the shark. All I see is the teeth, right? So I'm looking into this thing's mouth and I'm like, oh my God, what do I do here? And the only thing I could think to do is take a big breath and blow bubbles at the shark because I'm on scuba. So I do that. I take this huge breath and I blow out and, the shark swims away. It was afraid of my bubbles. And I thought to myself, well, this is awesome. They're just fish. I got this. Same shark does another circle, comes back and lands right in front of my face. I'm looking at his teeth again. I'm like, well, I got this. I understand this. I take a big breath and I blow out all my bubbles. I blow out so many bubbles you can't see for a second. It just obscures my vision and the bubble's clear and the shark is still hovering there. So on the second time he got this down and was sure he knew how to handle the situation. But yeah, I mean, just stuff like that. That's being that close to an animal that could absolutely end you is an interesting experience.
And clearly the shark got bored and left at some point.
He got bored when the fish ran out. When the fish stopped raining down from the surface, he realized that there wasn't anything to be had here.
You're doing that, or you're thousands of feet underwater looking at the Titanic, or you're inside King Tut's tomb, or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. How much do you allow yourself to let your jaw drop in wonder before you have to set out about the technical business of imaging these sites?
It's actually sort of never before I start the technical imaging, because I usually get there and I'm so nervous to get the job done and you know, make it beautiful and make it perfect. And that it's usually about halfway through that, at least on every job, I look around at one point and think, how on earth did I get here? I mean, this is so amazing and beautiful. And yeah, it's but it never fails. Every single place we've ever been, whether it is inside of a church or inside of a cave or, you know, flying over the Congo, the world's an amazing place.
Well, and at some level, you know, what you're doing is you're allowing the rest of us to access these places, partly because that means we don't have to go and disturb them, but partly because, you know, most of us couldn't get to, you know, to King Tut's tomb or the Titanic or whatever. But at the same time, you kind of have the best of both worlds. You're imaging them, but you're physically there as well. So you do become kind of an explorer in this way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we all consider ourselves explorers here, and we've been places that no one's ever been before. And one of the cool things about sharing this stuff is it's not just like we're imaging the outside of, say, Chichen Itza or something like that. We're going inside of every tomb and inside of every building, you know, with permissions from the Mexican government and the archaeologists, so that we can give them the science data, but we can also share it with the world in a way that you'll never see it as a tourist. It's sort of a behind-the-scenes pass to see it just the same way that we do.
How much of that work are you doing, or who's lobbying, say, the Mexican government to allow you to go to do this?
A lot of that's my co-founder, Mark Bauman. And the great thing is because we're adding to the science, we give all of our data sets at no cost to the governments and the local stakeholders. And then we actually give a fair bit of the revenue back to the local nonprofits so they can maintain and protect these physical places while we're sharing the digital ones. And because of that model, it's actually been really easy to be able to collaborate with the governments around the world in order to get this sort of stuff done.
What are the limitations at this point? Is it the technology with which you can do this work, or is it the technology that's available to, you know, either distribute it or showcase it? There are not a ton of museums that necessarily have the kind of equipment yet that you're able to, you know, that you would be able to produce material for.
That's exactly right. It's the display technology that lags. So when we capture these places, let's say we capture a church, we'll capture that in maybe 100 billion 3D points. And that's more than any computer system in the world can show. So, you know, we've got to take that and reduce it and make it smaller. And that's what our 3D art team does, makes it something that's displayable. But even then, in a lot of these venues like museums and location-based entertainment, they don't have the platforms to show them. So that's why we're working on as well different display technologies, whether it's augmented reality that doesn't need glasses, or it's dome-based projection, ways to share this at physical locations like that.
How do you see this work fitting in with the kind of Instagram culture that we have today, where, you know, it's sort of not enough to see a place, but people want to, you know, have a picture of themselves in front of a place?
That's a great question. So one of the things that we can do with this data, like we showed you on the VR headset downstairs, is we can put you in a headset and you can walk around a physical room, and to you it looks like you're walking around the Church of the Nativity or the grounds of Chichen Itza. So what we can also do is, using an external camera, we can capture people in that environment almost like a virtual selfie, but in the real 3D environment. So it's pretty cool.
Well, and the great irony to this, to some of it anyway, is that you, when you go and image a site, you're actually editing the tourists out of it.
Exactly. Yep. We're always editing tourists out. I mean, if you think about an experience you want to have walking through the grounds of Petra, Jordan, the ancient Nabataean site, you really don't want to do that with 40,000 other tourists. You want to be able to walk through the buildings and see them and not hear, you know, people hollering and trying to make echoes and stuff like that. So yeah, we edit out all the people, and in our experiences, you and the people you're with are the only ones in the whole site.
Can you develop like a virtual reality unpleasant bus ride out to these sites?
Totally. I think that one wouldn't be a great seller, but we could absolutely do that.
So why are we here in an unassuming building in Delafield and not at Nat Geo headquarters in DC or you know, with all due respect to Delafield, someplace flashier?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so a lot of our work is in LA and Washington, DC and, you know, places like that. But I lived in DC while working at Nat Geo and lived in Colorado while running Hydra Technologies. My whole family and my wife's family, she's the youngest of nine, are from the area. And even though we moved out one winter, you know, to other states and decided we would never move back because these winters are horrible, you know, at some point the draw of the family is enough that you decide to move back home.
How much time do you spend in the field versus the amount of time that you're back here in Wisconsin?
It varies. In a busy month, spend the whole month in the field, but I would say probably about half the time or so in the field and half the time here, which is sort of a nice balance. You know, you get to enjoy the Wisconsin summers, but in the winter, try to spend most of your time in the field.
Well, listen, Corey Jaskolski, it's amazing stuff, and I hope we get to talk again and kind of show some of this stuff off in an audio way.
Well, thanks. Looking forward to it.
Corey Jaskolski is the Chief Technology Officer at the Delafield-based Virtual Wonders. He'll also be the speaker at the latest Science on Tap lecture at the Milwaukee Public Museum next Thursday evening. You can find more information about that from a link at wuwm.com.